Chapter 13. Room 2318 of the Rayburn House office building was uncharacteristically packed with reporters and spectators. Open hearings of the House Subcommittee on Energy and the Environment seldom drew more than a handful of onlookers. But in light of the President's mandate on greenhouse gas emissions, the resulting media firestorm brought a flurry of attention to the subcommittee and its previously scheduled hearing. Its topic? The status of new technologies to aid the battle against global warming. The assembled crowd slowly hushed as an anteroom door opened and 18 members of Congress filed to their respective seats on the dais. The last member to enter was an attractive woman with cinnamon-colored hair. She was dressed in a deep purple Prada jacket and skirt, which nearly matched the hue of her violet eyes. Lauren Smith, devoted congresswoman from Colorado's 7th District, had never traded away her femininity since arriving at the blue-suited halls of Congress years before. Even in her 40s, she still made a smart and stylish appearance, but her colleagues had learned long ago that Lauren's beauty and fashion sense did nothing to lessen her skill and intelligence in the political arena. Walking gracefully to the center of the dais, she took her seat next to a plump, white-haired congressman from Georgia who chaired the committee. "I call this hearing to order," he brayed with a thick accent. "Given the public interest in our topic, I will forego opening remarks today and invite our first speaker to testify." He turned and gave a quick wink to Lauren, who smiled in return. Longtime colleagues and friends, despite sitting on different sides of the aisle, they were among a rare minority of House members who shunned partisan grandstanding in order to focus on the good of the country. A succession of industry and academic leaders took turns testifying on the latest advances in energy alternatives that emitted zero carbon. While offering up sunny long-term prospects, every speaker wavered when pressed by the committee to provide an immediate technological solution. "Volume production of hydrogen hasn't been perfected yet," testified one expert. "Even if every man, woman, and child in the country had a hydrogen fuel cell car, there wouldn't be enough hydrogen available to power a fraction of them."
"How far off are we?" asked a representative from Missouri.
"Probably 10 years," the witness replied. A ripple of murmurs quickly spread across the gallery. The story was the same from each spokesperson. Advances in technology and product improvements were hitting the marketplace, but the progress was being made in baby steps, not leaps and bounds. There was no imminent breakthrough that would satisfy the president's mandate and save the country and the world from the physical and economic devastation of accelerated global warming. The final speaker was a short, bespectacled man who headed up the GWU Environmental Research and Technology Lab in suburban Maryland. Lauren leaned forward and smiled as she recognized Lisa Lane taking a seat next to Dr. Horace Maxwell. After the lab director made a preliminary statement, Lauren jumped in with the initial questioning.
"Dr. Maxwell, your lab is at the forefront of alternate fuels research. Can you tell us what technological advances we might expect from your work in the near term?"
Maxwell nodded before speaking in a hen-like voice.
"We have several outstanding research programs in solar energy, biofuels, and hydrogen synthesis. But in answer to your question, I'm afraid we have no imminent product development that will satisfy the president's tough new mandate."
Lauren noticed Lisa bite her lip at Maxwell's last remark. The rest of the House panel took over and grilled Maxwell for another hour, but it was clear there was to be no noteworthy revelation. The president had gone out on a limb to challenge the brightest minds of industry and academia to solve the energy problem, but he was clearly striking out. As the hearing was adjourned and the reporters rushed out of the chamber to file their stories, Lauren stepped down and thanked Dr. Maxwell for his testimony, then greeted Lisa.
"Hi, Rumi,"
she smiled, giving a hug to her old college roommate.
"I thought you were still at Brookhaven National Laboratory in New York."
"No, I left a few months ago to join Dr. Maxwell's program.
He had more funds for blue sky research."
She grinned.
"I've been meaning to call you since I moved back to Washington, but I've just been swamped."
"I can sympathize. With the president's speech, the work at your lab has suddenly become very important."
Lisa's face turned solemn and she moved closer to Lauren.
I really would like to talk to you about my own research work, she said in a low voice.
Would dinner tonight work? My husband is picking me up in half an hour. We'd love to have you join us. Lisa thought for a moment.
I'd like that. Let me tell Dr. Maxwell that I'll make my own way home tonight. Your husband won't mind driving?
Lauren laughed.
Taking a pretty girl for a ride is one of his favorite pastimes.
Lauren and Lisa stood on the north steps of the Rayburn building as a string of limos and Mercedes sedans rolled through the dignitary lane, picking up the wealthier members of Congress and their ever-hovering lobbyists. Lisa was distracted by the appearance of the House Majority Leader and nearly missed seeing a rakish antique convertible come barreling to the curb, nearly creasing her thigh with its high-turned fender. She stared wide-eyed as a rugged-looking man with ebony hair and sparkling green eyes hopped out of the car and grabbed Lauren in a tight embrace, then kissed her passionately.
"Lisa," Lauren said, pushing the man away with a tinge of embarrassment, "this is my husband. Dirk Pitt."
Pitt saw the look of surprise in Lisa's eyes and smiled warmly as he shook her hand.
"Don't worry," he laughed. "I only maul pretty women if they're members of Congress."
Lisa felt herself blush slightly. She saw an adventuresome glow in his eyes, tempered by a warm soul.
"I invited Lisa to join us for dinner," Lauren explained.
"Glad for you to come." "I just hope you don't mind a little wind," Pitt said, nodding toward the car.
"That's some set of wheels," Lisa stammered. "What is it?"
"A 1932 Auburn Speedster. I just finished rebuilding the brakes last night and thought it would be fun to take her out."
Lisa gazed at the sleek car, painted in dual shades of cream and blue. The open cockpit offered cramped seating for two, and there was no back seat. Instead, the bodywork behind the driver's compartment flared to a triangular point at the rear bumper, in the classic boat tail shape.
"I don't think there is room for all of us," she lamented.
"There is, if somebody doesn't mind riding in back," Pitt replied. He walked over and pushed down on the flush topside surface of the boat tail. A hideaway seat folded back, revealing a one-passenger compartment.
"Oh, my. I've always wanted to ride in a rumble seat," Lisa said. Without hesitation, she climbed onto a foot bracket and hopped into the compartment.
"My grandfather used to tell me how he rode in the rumble seat of his father's Packard during the Depression," she explained.
"No better way to see the world," Pitt joked, winking at her before helping Lauren into the front seat. They loped through rush hour traffic along the mall and across the George Mason Bridge before heading south into Virginia. As the city monuments grew smaller behind them, the traffic lightened and Pitt mashed down on the accelerator. With a smooth and powerful 12-cylinder engine under the hood, the sleek Auburn quickly sprinted past the speed limit. As the car accelerated, Lisa grinned and waved like a little girl at the passing traffic, enjoying the wind as it rustled through her hair. Up front, Lauren placed a hand on Pitt's knee and smiled at her husband, who always seemed to find a touch of adventure wherever he went. Pitt drove past Mount Vernon, then exited the main highway. At a small crossroad, he turned down a dirt road that meandered through the trees until ending at a small restaurant facing the Potomac River. Pitt parked the Auburn and turned off the motor as the heavy scent of Old Bay seasoning filled the air. "Best spiced crabs in the territory," Pitt promised. The restaurant was an old riverside home converted to a cafe, plainly decorated but with a cozy atmosphere. They were seated at a table overlooking the Potomac as a crowd of locals began filtering in.
"Lauren tells me you are a research chemist at GWU, Pitt said to Lisa after ordering a round of beers and crab.
"Yes, I'm part of an environmental studies group looking at the global warming problem," she replied.
"If you ever get bored, NUMA can put you to work on some cutting-edge undersea research," he offered with a smile. "We have a large team studying the effects of ocean warming and higher acidity levels. I just had a project review with a team studying carbon saturation in the oceans and possible means of boosting carbon absorption in deep water."
"With all the focus on the atmosphere, I'm glad to see someone is paying attention to the oceans as well." It sounds like there might be some parallels with my research. I'm working on a project related to airborne carbon reduction. I'd love to see the results of your team's work.
It's just a preliminary report, but you might find it useful. I'll send a copy to you. Or better yet, I'll drop it off to you in the morning. I have an appearance to make on the Hill myself, he added, rolling his eyes at Lauren.
All executive agencies must justify their annual budgets, Lauren replied, especially those run by renegade pirates. She laughed and gave Pitt a hug, then turned to her friend.
Lisa, you seemed anxious after the hearing today to discuss your research work. Tell me more about it.
Lisa took a large swallow from her beer, then looked at Lauren with trusting eyes.
I haven't spoken of this to anyone besides my lab assistant, but I believe we have hit upon a profound discovery.
She spoke in a quiet voice, as if afraid the neighboring diners might hear.
Go on, Lauren urged, drawn close by Lisa's demeanor. My research involves molecular manipulation of hydrocarbons. We've discovered an important catalyst that I believe will allow for artificial photosynthesis on a mass scale.
Do you mean, like, in plants? Converting light into energy?
Yes, you remember your botany. But just to make sure, take that plant over there, she said, pointing to a large Boston fern dangling in a planter by the window. It captures light energy from the sun, water from the soil, and carbon dioxide from the air to produce carbohydrates, the fuel source for it to grow. Its only waste product is oxygen, which allows the rest of us to survive. That's the basic cycle of photosynthesis.
Yet the actual process is so complicated, scientists have been unable to duplicate it, Pitt said with growing interest. Lisa sat quietly as the waitress appeared and unrolled a sheet of brown butcher paper on the table, then dumped a small mountain of steamed blue crabs in front of them. When they each began attacking a spiced crab with a wood mallet, she continued.
You're correct in the general sense. Elements of photosynthesis have been successfully duplicated, but none with anywhere near the efficiency seen in nature. The complexity is very real. That's why the hundreds of scientists around the world working on artificial photosynthesis typically focus on just a component of the process.
Yourself included? Lauren asked.
Myself included. The research at our lab is focused on the ability of plants to break down water molecules into their individual elements. If we can duplicate the process efficiently, and we'll get there someday, then we'll have an unlimited source of cheap hydrogen fuel at our disposal.
Your breakthrough is in another direction? Lauren asked.
My focus has been on a reaction called Photosystem 1 and the breakdown of carbon dioxide that occurs in the process.
What are the primary challenges? Pitt asked.
Lisa tore into a second crab, sucking the meat out of a hind claw.
These are delicious, by the way.
The basic problem has been in developing an efficient means of triggering a chemical breakdown. Chlorophyll plays that role in nature, but it decomposes too quickly in the lab. The trick I pursued was to find an artificial catalyst that could break down carbon dioxide molecules.
Lisa set down her food, then spoke in a low voice again.
That's where I came up with a solution. Blundered upon it, actually. I left a rhodium sample in the test chamber by mistake and added to it another element called ruthenium. When combined with a light charge, the reaction was an immediate dimerization of the CO2 molecules into oxalate.
Lauren wiped her hands of crab juice and took a sip of beer.
All of this chemistry is starting to make my head spin, she complained.
You sure it's not the beer and the bay seasoning? Pitt asked with a grin.
I'm sorry. Lisa said, most of my friends are biochemists, so I sometimes forget to take off my verbal lab coat.
Lauren has a much better head for public policy than for science, Pitt kidded. You were mentioning the outcome of your experiment?
In other words, the catalytic reaction converted the carbon dioxide into a simple compound. With further processing, we can get to a carbon-based fuel such as ethanol. But the critical reaction was the actual breakdown of the carbon dioxide.
The pile of crabs had been transformed into a mass of broken claws and empty shells. The middle-aged waitress deftly cleared away the mess and returned a short time later with coffee and key lime pie for the table.
"Forgive me, but I'm not sure I understand what you were saying," Lauren said between bites.
Lisa gazed out the window at some twinkling lights on the far side of the river.
"I'm quite certain that the application of my catalyst can be used to construct a high-output artificial photosynthesis device."
"Could it be expanded to industrial proportions?" Pitt asked. Lisa nodded with a humble look.
"I'm sure of it. All that is needed is some light, rhodium, and ruthenium to make it tick."
Lauren shook her head.
"So what you're saying is that we'll be able to produce a facility that can filter carbon dioxide into a harmless substance? And the process can be applied to power plants and other industrial polluters?"
"Yes, that's the prospect. But even more than that."
"What do you mean?"
"Hundreds of facilities could be built. In terms of carbon reduction, it'd be like putting a pine forest in a box."
"So you're talking about actually reducing the existing levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere," Pitt stated.
Lisa nodded again, her lips pursed tight. Lauren grabbed Lisa's hand and squeezed it hard.
"Then you've found a genuine solution to global warming."
The words came out in a whisper. Lisa looked sheepishly at her pie and nodded.
"The process is sound. There's still work ahead. But I see no reason why we can't have a large-scale artificial photosynthesis facility designed and built in a matter of months. All it will take is money and political support," she said, looking at Lauren.
Lauren was too startled to eat her dessert.
"But the hearing's today," she said. "Why didn't Dr. Maxwell mention it?"
Lisa stared up at the fern.
"I haven't told him yet," she replied quietly. "I only just made the discovery a few days ago. To be honest, I was a little overwhelmed at the findings. My research assistant convinced me not to tell Dr. Maxwell before the hearings until we were sure about the results. We were both afraid of the potential media frenzy."
"You would have been right about that," Pitt agreed.
"So do you still have doubts about the results?" Lauren asked.
Lisa shook her head.
"We've duplicated the results at least a dozen times, with consistent results. There is no question in my mind that the catalyst works."
"Then it is time to act," Lauren urged. "Brief Maxwell tomorrow, and I'll follow up with an innocuous hearing question. Then I'll try and get us in to see the president."
"The president?"
Lisa blushed.
"Absolutely. We'll need an executive order to put a crash production program into place until an emergency funding bill can be authorized. The president clearly understands the carbon problem. If the solution is within our grasp, I'm sure he will act immediately."
Lisa fell silent, overcome by the ramifications. Finally, she nodded her head.
"You're right, of course. I'll do it. Tomorrow."
Pitt paid the bill and the trio drifted out to the car. They drove home in relative silence, their thoughts absorbed on the magnitude of Lisa's discovery. When Pitt pulled up in front of Lisa's townhouse in Alexandria, Lauren jumped out and gave her old friend a hug.
"I'm so proud of what you've done," she said. "We used to joke about changing the world. Now you really have."
She smiled.
"Thanks for giving me the courage to go forward," Lisa replied.
"Good night, Dirk," she said, waving at Pitt. "Don't forget, I'll see you in the morning with the ocean carbon report." After Lauren climbed back into the car, Pitt slid the gear shift into first and sped down the street.
"Georgetown or the hangar?" he asked Lauren.
She snuggled close to him.
"The hangar tonight."
Pitt smiled as he steered the Auburn toward Reagan National Airport. Though married, they still kept separate residences. Lauren maintained a fashionable townhouse in Georgetown, but spent most of her time at Pitt's eclectic home. Reaching the grounds of the airport, he drove down a dusty side road toward a dark, vacant section of the field. Passing through an electric gate,
He pulled up in front of a dimly lit hangar that looked as if it had been collecting dust for several decades. Pitt pressed the security code on a wireless transmitter and watched as a side door to the hangar slid open. A bank of overhead lights popped on, revealing a glistening interior that resembled a transportation museum. Dozens of brightly polished antique cars were neatly aligned in the center of the building. Along one wall, a majestic Pullman railroad car sat parked on a set of steel tracks embedded in the floor. A rusty bathtub with an ancient outboard motor bolted to the side, and a weathered and dilapidated semi-inflatable boat sat incongruously nearby. As Pitt pulled into the hangar, the Auburn's headlights flashed on a pair of aircraft parked at the back of the building, one an old Ford trimotor and the other a sleek World War II Messerschmitt ME-162 jet. The planes, like many of the cars in the collection, were relics of past adventures. Even the bathtub and raft told a tale of peril and lost love that Pitt retained as sentimental reminders of life's frailty. Pitt parked the Auburn next to a 1921 Rolls-Royce Silver Ghost that was undergoing restoration and turned off the motor. As the garage door closed behind them, Lauren turned to Pitt and asked, "What would my constituents think if they knew I was living in an abandoned aircraft hangar?" "They'd probably feel pity for you and increase their campaign donations," Pitt replied with a laugh. He took her hand and led her up a spiral staircase to a loft apartment in one corner of the building. Lauren had exercised her marriage rights and coerced Pitt to remodel the kitchen and add an extra room to the apartment, which she used as an exercise area and office. But she knew better than to touch the brass portholes, ship paintings, and other nautical artifacts that gave the residence a decidedly masculine tone. "Do you really think Lisa's discovery will be able to reverse global warming?" Lauren asked, pouring two glasses of Pinot Noir from a bottle labeled Sea Smoke Patella. "Given enough resources, there seems no reason to think that it can't happen. Of course, going from the lab to real-world production is always more problematic than people think. But if a working design already exists, then the hard part is done." Lauren walked across the room and handed Pitt a glass. "Once the bombshell hits, it is going to get pretty hectic," she said, already dreading the demands on her time. Pitt hooked an arm around her waist and drew her tight to him. "That's all right," he smiled with a yearning grin. "We've still got tonight before the wolves start howling."